Hello and welcome to The Wind is the original radio podcast, where we have conversations with the best nature listeners. My name is Melissa and I am creating this podcast with Earth FM. Today, we have the pleasure to talk to no other than George Flood, whose prolific work in a vast number of regions and ecosystems has been featured in many award-winning documentaries, fiction films and video games. We chat about George's personal connection with sound, field recording ethics, his mind shift about human sounds in natural soundscapes, creativity, and much more. We are very grateful for George's time and his many recordings that you can listen to on Earth FM, on our site and in our app, which is free to download for iOS and Android. If you feel like you're aligned with our mission, consider becoming a member or donating to our nonprofit so that we can continue to bring you wonderful soundscapes around the world recorded by the best artists. Join us at earth.fm and foster your connection with our beautiful planet. And now, on to our episode.
I am George Flood. I'm a sound recordist and collector of sounds. I like to focus on nature and wildlife, but I've also recorded aircraft and firearms and explosions and people and music. And I've had the pleasure of working on a couple of interesting projects, including Dune Part 2 and Mufasa the Lion King. I've also worked on a whole bunch of other projects. I've worked on documentary work and some TV series and podcasts and audiobooks and things like that. You know, I've contributed my sound recordings to a wide variety of media. But my main focus, my main passion, and the love of my life is to be out in nature, to listen to birdsong and wildlife sounds, to understand them as well, not just to collect them mindlessly, and then to share them with people, with whoever's happy to listen to this stuff. When I started out, I used to be very fastidious. I think that's the perfect word to describe it. I was always trying to get away from man-made sound, and the tiniest of very distant car engine or aircraft would drive me nuts. I was really frustrated. I was like, why don't these people just stay home instead of coming out and ruining my recording? But ever since then, I've become a bit more flexible with this stuff and more understanding. Obviously, it's impossible for nature to be as it was 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. We are moving forward, whether we like it or not. You know, progress happens. People need to travel. People need to use power tools and whatever. So my work nowadays focuses more on getting away from these things. And then when I don't have a choice, I like to record as much as possible. So if I need an hour of birdsong recorded in the UK, for example, I'm probably going to record for a couple of weeks to get, enough material, enough flexibility. In Scotland, for example, 2 or 3 years ago, I was able to record for half an hour without any disturbance, which is way more than I was able to record in the south here where I live. So I think that if I look outside my window now, there's probably 6 or 7 aircraft in the sky. I can hear 2 or 3 of them for sure. So it's not a good place to be for nature sound recording. But as I said, considerations vary. You know, some people want to record that human element. It's also a bit reductive to think about nature as separate from humans, right? Whether we like it or not, we do influence nature. I also noticed that some birds become a bit louder when there's a disturbance in the environment, when there's a distant engine sound, for example. That might be good for us, for our purposes as sound recordists. I'm not sure if it's, whether it's good for the ecosystem or for the species' survival in the long term. But at the moment, with my recordings, I try to be as flexible as possible. So I'm recording soundscapes for at least 1 hour, you know, maybe 5 days at a time, sometimes even longer. And then I also like to focus on species, because that's a very useful type of material to have for telling stories and for using in various media. People like to engage with this stuff. People's introduction to wildlife and to nature is usually the song of a bird. You know, they might hear something in their backyard and they start wondering. They will say, okay, let me find out what this bird song is. And they're going to look through a whole bunch of bird song on YouTube or wherever, or on the BTO website or something. And then, you know, before you know it, they become hooked. They become birders and like to bird watch and things like that. So any way I can add more purposes to my work, you know, it's very welcome. I don't run away from man-made sound anymore. I like to record people as well. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of the sounds of, you know, combustion engines. They are disturbing. They're not good. They're stressful. They induce anxiety and stuff. But, you know, when I was in Madagascar, you know, I was waking up at 4 a.m., setting up some rigs on the balcony of my little hut in a small village far away from anything. That was purely the sound of humans waking up, you know, livestock, poultry, things like that. I like that sound. That sound is pleasant. That, you know, it's probably due to the fact that I grew up in the countryside as well, where I learned to love nature and to live with nature rather than control it. So yeah, at the moment I'm not as anxious when I'm out recording anymore. I just try to do my homework, to research as much as possible and to try and focus on the things I need to record. But if I have a bit more freedom, more flexibility, I can just record anything and everything. For me, it was part of a longer journey. When I started out in working in sound, I was mostly a sound designer working in the studio. And then transitioning to some field work I used to do, you know, maybe once a week or something like that, I was looking at sound recordings as tools or assets that I could use in my day-to-day work exclusively. So nothing else. I wasn't considering the ecosystem or how a sound, you know, can indicate the health of a habitat or something. Right. Slowly, I started to become more interested in how it works and the species behind the dawn chorus, for example. And as I dug deeper and I learned more, I realized that nothing exists separately. And for me to think about it in terms of usefulness or purpose like that, it's a bit reductive. It's a bit selfish. And as I shifted my mindset from that to, you know, capturing the whole soundscape and the sound of the ecosystem, I realized that even if a sound recording is useless for sound design, it is there is beauty in it, and we could listen to it and just enjoy it like we would do with music. And then, of course, if you introduce the distant sounds of a village, for example, in there, it's more or less the same thing. I like hearing human voices. The human voice is a beautiful sound. I wasn't really aware of it, but at one point I was in the village I grew up in back in Romania, and I found myself yearning for the sounds that I grew up with. Some of them, they're still there, but some are missing now. People don't have cattle anymore. You know, there's big farms somewhere, you know, far away, but there's not that small subsistence farm that I grew up with anymore. So the biodiversity, if you will, of a local farm is more limited now. So I was trying to find the perfect spot where I could hear, you know, cows mooing, roosters crowing. I think there was geese. What else was I listening for? Some other elements like that. People maybe talking, and then the distant sounds of a bell tolling in the church, plus the whole symphony of nature in the morning, you know, in May, June. And I couldn't find that. It was very difficult. But then I realized, well, you know, 10 years ago, I would have thought this is rubbish. I don't want to hear all these human sounds in my recordings. And now I'm actually looking for it. So that was probably the moment I recognized that my definition of a good soundscape is changing.
What aspects do you think are important for nature field recorders to have in mind when working, especially outside their homes and culture, and also when promoting their work online?
I think, in my work at least, working with local people, people that have been in a certain place for ages and they've grown up there, just opens my mind to a lot of things that I would ignore otherwise. And sometimes it can be beneficial to my work if I'm looking for a species that I wouldn't find otherwise. Talking to local people, they'll explain to me, you know, yes, when I was a kid, I used to hear it, you know, by the river, for example. There's an owl that calls at night or something like that. And then finding out about the mythology that comes with that species and the legends they have and the stories they have, that provides a lot more context. And you might wonder why a species is thriving, even though it might be endangered in other locations. Well, maybe the village has a certain taboo about killing it or whatever, hunting it. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is hidden just below the surface. You just have to dig deep enough and find out and ask questions and be open-minded about it. Yeah, so in the field, you see a lot of people going out and recording in a very mindless way, disturbing the environment, for one, and then causing maybe damage, you know, breaking trees and chasing wildlife around a certain habitat. I may have done that as well, you know, when I was starting out. I've learned to be a bit more mindful about it, to be a bit more careful. I prefer working with drop rigs, with passive recording systems, because it's easier both for me, you know, I can set it up and leave it there and it's not going to bother anyone. But for the wildlife as well, because if you're present and you're trying to record something, you're mostly going to get a reaction to your presence in the environment. With a rig that's been there for 5 days, wildlife just starts to ignore it. They don't care about it anymore. So that's a big one for me. I know this is a bit controversial. I've had very heated discussions with nature sound recorders and bird sound recorders in particular, who would say that setting up a rig somewhere and going back to your accommodation having tea is rubbish, you know, is you're cheating. Well, I don't see it as cheating as much as, you know, being able to cover more distance and more locations and more species. And it's just, you know, the way I've started to do things, and it seems to be working for me. I've also done recording in person with a Telinga dish or with a shotgun microphone. So, you know, I'm not against that. But yeah, and then promoting your material. In some situations, you have to think about what you're doing and what you're sharing. For example, when I was in Australia, there are some locations that are sacred for the local Aboriginal people. And I chose not to even film them. You know, for example, Uluru, there are some locations where only men are allowed, and there are different locations where only women are allowed. You know, that's their culture. And for me to go there and take photos of that and just put it online mindlessly would be awful. And I chose not to do that. We chose to just get like very distant shots of Uluru. I mean, from that, there's a lot of stuff that you need to find out. You need to do your due diligence. It's not about what you think is valid, it's about what other people think is valid. You know, it's all, you know, being careful, being mindful, trying not to create tension and problems. This is just being a human. It's just being a nice person, having common sense. It's not necessarily just about sound recording.
Sometimes it's just about the right choice for the specific situation, right? I often see that our culture socially rewards the more suffering you go through the natural elements, as if that alone adds value to the recording. And on the other hand, if you are lucky to have a somewhat comfortable expedition, it makes it less important or its perceived value is less. But you can have a very comfortable expedition trip and still be recording a very important ecosystem for many, many reasons and still produce very beautiful recordings that touch people in a way or another.
I totally agree with that. And I found myself thinking about this often. So for example, I have like the extreme expeditions that I go to, for example, Sumatra or Gabon. It was tough. I got a bunch of diseases and it was painful. And I had to come back and spend 2 months taking antibiotics and trying to get better. But that didn't make the sound recordings better. It's just Sumatra, just being there. Right. The sound is good in a village as well. You can just drive in, put the recorder out of the window and record some lovely sounds. Sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes I have to do like really crazy stuff like spending time in a very nice lodge with air conditioning and amazing food and being driven around because you can't walk around in many places in Africa. You know, that comes with the territory, I guess. You know, sometimes it's lively and exciting. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes you have to be in good shape to get to certain places. There's no rule. You know, you have both of these and both are perfectly fine. I don't think making the experience all about yourself is a good idea in any situation. And then there may be some people who are attracted to this sort of extreme nature of some of the stuff that we do as sound recordists. But that's just focusing on the wrong aspect. You know, the soundscapes are more valuable and the sounds recorded are more valuable than the effort you put in or the leeches that suck your blood or whatever.
Mm-hmm, right. And that being said, what are you afraid of in the field?
There's existential questions like that. easy ones. I'm not afraid of many things in the field. I think I suffer from I forget what it's called. You know, when you grow up with cats, there's a parasite that cats can give you where it makes you a bit fearless and more prone to getting into car accidents and things.
Oh, okay. And have you gotten that?
I have a thing. I was talking to a random guy I met in the Amazon who would go and catch anacondas, you know, swim and then catch them underwater and bring them above water, you know. Mm-hmm. It was, he most certainly had that because he had had cats from a very young age growing up. And I sometimes recognize myself in that. You know, I was in Gabon and we found a snake in the grass right next to the water bottles. And I almost reached for it. And then instead of going away, I got my camera and was getting as close as possible to it so I get a nice shot. Mm-hmm. And many situations like that. I don't know. I don't feel like I'm afraid of things that I should be. I have a deep respect for nature and wildlife, so I'm not going to bother a snake if it's just going by its daily business. But I'm afraid of losing my kit if it's critical for my work, if I'm on a contract and I have to record something very specific. And there's only one way to do that, and I lack my equipment, or I've lost it, or I've broken it. That is a big problem. So I usually bring a whole lot of spares. Even so, I was in Japan, luckily on a personal project, you know, it was a recce for a client, but it wasn't that critical. I went there with two hydrophones. I was trying to record the sound of sea ice and both hydrophones died right away. And I had not brought, you know, the third and fourth spare. So I was really kicking myself for that.
And was that because of the cold temperatures or?
I just received them on the day I left. And I had not tested them, which is another thing that I need to work on. I need to test everything thoroughly before I go on a trip. But yeah, that's the kind of stuff I'm afraid of. You know, all my kit being stolen or lost in transit or misplaced or, you know.
What is your or one of your most memorable place or moment regarding field recording?
Most memorable place moment? There's lots of them. You know, whenever someone asks me, I tend to give a different answer, and I might sound like I'm a bit inconsistent. I think, you know, sleeping on the edge of an active volcano in Ethiopia without having taken any precautions. That was the problem on that trip. I was traveling with a friend of mine and his dad. His dad is a geologist, and we had a bit of discussion before the trip. He said we should be fine to go to go on the edge of a volcano. But on the trip, when we were there, I found out that he's a geologist that works in oil and gas. So he has nothing to do with volcanoes. And he knew nothing, next to zero, about volcanoes. And that volcano emits a lot of gases. There's like a thick plume of smoke that has silica particles suspended in it. And if you inhale those, it's like inhaling bits of glass. It's going to cut your lungs open inside. It's very nasty stuff. Luckily, we had bits of fabric, you know, like little head wraps we got from the local people, and we were using those instead of breathing masks. It was fine. We weren't downwind from the volcano. I haven't noticed any issues. You know, my friends were okay afterwards. But yeah, that's a memorable place. You know, it was tough getting there. It was tough to work there. It was very hot, but the sounds were amazing. Just witnessing that, being on the edge of a volcano, seeing lava spewing and, you know, hearing all that chaos, that really intense sound, is something that you don't forget very easily.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine, because it's also not only difficult to access for most of us, but also the extremes of nature manifestation in our planet, right? Like, it's that must be really almost like a religious experience, maybe. I don't know, something like that.
Almost, yeah. It's like the planet's farting and you're right there to witness it. It's, you know, it's intense.
Amazing. Related, do you have a favorite sound? And it could be your cat purring. It's one of my favorite sounds.
Yep, my cat purring is a good sound. I haven't even recorded it yet, though, for some reason. With the sounds that are easy to record, I kind of tend to put them off and just focus on stuff that is more difficult to record. I think I touched on it earlier. I think human voice is a lovely sound. It's beautiful to listen to. There's something about, you know, there's some of this ASMR trend that we've seen for probably a decade now. Human voice that is just intended for someone, for yourself to hear, you know, like whispers and things like that tend to... Even if it's like talking nothing or rubbish, it gives it more meaning, because as we've developed, you know, over genetically over eons, hundreds of thousands of years, we tend to pay attention to whispers more than to screams, I guess, somehow. It's more intimate. It's more, maybe it's like secrets or something. And I've found that elevates experiences. When I work in sound design and I've added little whispers and things, you know, or silence or voice that is not necessarily in your face, people tend to pay more attention to that subconsciously. But obviously that's not field recording, you know, it's more studio recording or whatever. Sounds from the field, you know, a lovely donk horse is difficult to beat wherever it is. You know, that can be in the UK here, if you can get away from the man-made sound, or in the rainforest, or even in the desert sometimes you have a little bit of donk horse.
How do you feel that traveling so much to a variety of places and cultures with an attentive ear and eye, presumably, has changed you as a human being?
Oh, very good question. I feel like I used to listen a lot as a kid. A lot of my early memories from, you know, like 4 or 5 years old, are about sounds. I would hear birds that I couldn't recognize back then. I wonder, what is that sound? Like a deep crowing sound, which I know I can identify as a raven sound. And I've found where the ravens live and where they travel, you know, above, fly above the house that I lived in, and then go back in the evening. So this came very easily to me. I had no problem focusing on sound. I have more problem focusing on visuals or other things or tasks, but listening was always very easy, which I'm very fortunate about. You know, I understood that I can use this to my advantage, and I understood that not everyone is like that. I used to think everyone senses reality in the same way that I do. But obviously there are minute differences from person to person, and some are more extreme. I guess me and you and, you know, people who work in sound specifically are a bit more lucky and more gifted in this regard. But now I realize that I can pay attention for a whole day to sounds, you know, and don't get tired, you know, unless it's explosions or something that's really grating. But if I have to listen to dawn choruses from 6 a.m. until 7 or 8 p.m., I have no problem with that. That's actually pretty exciting for me. Mm-hmm. So I tend to use that in my work. When I travel, I realize that there is more and more and deeper I can go. In the process of developing this skill, I also realized that listening, you know, not necessarily in terms of listening to nature, but listening to people as well, and instead of trying to focus on what you're going to say next or trying to come up with an even crazier story, listening is a skill that is very overlooked and underrated. So, yeah, I guess it goes in parallel. I like to spend a lot of time listening, not saying anything, and then, you know, maybe come up with something that really addresses the stuff that I was listening to. Analyzing, it's also something that, well, I find it a bit difficult to turn off the analyzing. You know, I did a thing called deep listening in South Africa with Francisco Lopez and his team probably 10 years ago. And the task was to take a chair, go into the middle of the savannah, sit down for an hour and try not to think of anything, just to listen. And I found it very difficult to not try to identify the species, try to follow them with my ears. Where are they going? What are they doing? That kind of stuff. But that is as close as I could get to meditation. For me, meditation doesn't really work. I can never empty my brain of thoughts and reactions and things. But trying to focus on a soundscape and trying to just take the sounds in, that's probably what meditation is for me.
So picking up the name of your brand, Mindful Audio, how do you connect your field recording practice to mindfulness?
Yeah, mindful audio. So I had a very good person to learn from, a teacher. A friend of mine, he's very good with branding and marketing. So I was talking to him about stuff that I would like to do in life, not necessarily stuff that I was doing already. And I told him about how I like to listen to sounds. I like to record them. I like to pay attention to things. I was really into hydrophones and contact microphones back then, stuff that you have to go looking for and listening out for rather than just, you know, hearing by accident. And he brought up the word mindful, and I felt like it really described how I felt. And then I checked it out, and it was no such thing as Mindful Audio. You know, no, the website wasn't taken. So I got the domain name right away. And then it took me probably a year or so to find out what I wanted to do with Mindful Audio, basically. Because already working as gamesounds.com, which is, you know, sometimes I still use that. I still have a website that with that name. But I felt like I was slowly transitioning from just working on games to working with sound and perceiving sound in a certain way and describing it and telling stories, which all revolved around Mindful Audio. So we could all do that. We could all be more mindful in our lives. Nowadays, everything is about ourselves. We become narcissists by accident because that's what you end up doing on social media. Or if you don't do it, you don't exist. So being more mindful, paying more attention. Also, I think I've told this story before. I'm not sure if we talked about it, but I had a kind of a big situation where I was working too much and I broke down from too much work. I was really burnt out. I didn't enjoy what I was doing anymore. I was really exhausted. And that was a lack of mindfulness for me. I was not listening to my own body and my own brain telling me to stop and go outside and take a breath of fresh air. So yeah, that just hammered home the point that, yeah, mindfulness is where I'm aiming to be. Maybe I'm not there yet fully, but it's not a waste of time. It's pretty useful, pretty good in life.
So can you talk about what is your relationship to sound?
It's existential. As I said, from a young age, I could always hear things. I can hear things in my sleep. Sometimes I wake up because my cat is running up the stairs, has a zoomie at midnight or something like that. I can hear a lot of things that my wife doesn't care about. Sound is life for me, and I'm happy it's that way. I have to be more careful because sometimes if I'm in a new environment and it's very loud or there's too much wind. When I went to Patagonia, for example, 2 years ago, we lived in a hut on the edge of a big lake, and there was always wind there, like 40, 50 miles per hour wind, and the hut was shaking, and I found it very difficult to sleep because of what I was hearing at night. I was hearing all these creaks and you know, the bits of wood that was, they were hitting each other in the wind. And that's what sound is for me. You know, sound is always present. So I can't really close my ears to it or ignore it. And I don't even want to necessarily. As long as I get a good night's sleep, I'm generally okay. And then I can spend my whole day listening and analyzing what I'm hearing, telling other people about what I'm hearing and, you know, talking about this stuff, evangelizing sound and how we should focus more on sound. I don't mind it. That's my relationship with it. I used to analyze everything and I used to hear a species that didn't belong. Oh my God, they put a screaming pia in Africa. That's the worst thing in the world. But I managed to turn that off now. I can enjoy a film without necessarily listening out for things or hearing everything. Fun story. So when I work on Dune Part 2, it was a huge project, moving very fast. There was a lot of things changing from one day to the next. And after I had finished working, maybe a month before release, I realized that it wasn't very clear about my credit. I wasn't sure I was going to be credited or not. I organized an expedition to Algeria. I recorded most of the sounds that you hear, you know, wind in the film. But I was so anxious. I didn't know, am I going to be credited or not? You know, that meant a huge deal for me and it still means a huge deal. That film was probably my favorite project so far. And I went to watch the film in IMAX with my wife, and my hearing was so tense, you know, from that anxiety. I could hear every little footstep and every little grain of sand falling and being blown by the wind. And yeah, that was a religious experience, you know, hearing, that's my sound. My wife asked me, okay, tell me when you hear your sounds. And I said, that's my sound. And then she said, okay, you can stop it now. I can understand. But yeah, and at the end, I found that I was indeed credited and I was very happy. I almost cried. It was like a huge release. And yeah, that was a really, really intense experience, listening out and wondering, you know, being a bit anxious, also a bit excited. Yeah, very, very interesting. conservation is huge for me. Even before I started doing field recording, I was always into preserving the environment. I think it goes back to growing up with my grandparents in the countryside. For them, it was never a question of controlling nature or weather or making things happen regardless of what their circumstances are. For them, it was, since it's subsistence agriculture, you have to deal with, if there's a drought, what are you going to do? How do you adapt to that? If there's a flood, how do you adapt to that? If you have a very tough, very cold winter, how do you prepare for that? All of these things were reactionary. We have to work. This is the environment and the nature and the conditions we have. So we just have to work with it. It was a very stoicist approach to life, which I really loved. And it was never about earning more, maximizing returns or yields or anything. It was just about making enough so that they could feed the family and they would have a little bit extra, so just in case something bad happens or something goes wrong. But more often than not, we were just basically barely making it. And I never felt like it was a very precarious existence. It was just normal. Mm-hmm. And when you come from that to a time of plenty, where everything's available at every time of the year, you stop enjoying it as much. If there's pears available throughout the year, well, whatever, I don't care about pears anymore. We used to have a pear tree in the backyard. It was only in fruit for 2 weeks a year. That's when the fruit was ripe and ready to eat. And then that's it. That's done. I would eat all the pears I could. I'd climb that tree and eat all the pears during those 2 weeks. But then, again, going back to present time, everything's always available. Everything doesn't have any value anymore. We tend to use a lot of stuff that is overkill, literally. Pesticides and all this chemical fertilizer. When I was growing up, everything was a very closed circle. You take the dung from the animals, you put it in the field, and that's it. It helps grow your crops. You didn't use more than you could. You used just enough, just as much as you needed. There was always space for nature and wildlife. If there's a buzzard coming and stealing a chick, whatever, it's that's life. You're not going to kill the buzzard because the buzzard stole your chick. It's very different nowadays. And I find that I'm kind of like the old man yelling at clouds now. We're not taking care of Mother Earth and nature and this stuff anymore. Even around the village that I grew up in, you can only see monoculture nowadays. And there's much fewer birds of prey because there's nothing to prey on anymore. When you used to have alternating patches of different cultures every day, different types of crops, it was sustaining a much more biodiverse wildlife and ecosystem. I felt like as a kid, I had very good education in terms of conservation and just taking what is needed rather than having this huge plenty that makes you just waste resources and energy and food. So after I started to do sound recording, I realized it's even worse because in many locations where you go, you expect to hear good soundscapes with a lot of different species and you only hear two or three species because only those species can survive in those environments nowadays. Yeah, I don't know. I like to support as many of these initiatives as possible. I used to think that supporting the WWF and those big, huge NGOs is a good idea, but I know there's a lot of waste there as well. They have to use a lot of money just to keep up with daily tasks and to keep up that huge apparatus that they have. For me, whenever I meet someone who does work on the ground, maybe like a two or three person operation, those are the people that I want to help. Because if I donate $1,000 or $500 or $100, for WWF, it's not going to make a huge difference. But for someone who works in the mountains, in the Carpathian Mountains in Romania, they're going to be able to buy a pair of new boots and maybe a camera trap or something like that, and they can make a lot bigger difference than otherwise. NGOs like African Parks, for example, they take over national parks in Africa from governments and from countries. So I would like to see the one or two person NGO that can go to the government of Chad and say, okay, I'm going to take over your national park and run it for you and make it work. Because that's where you need a huge apparatus, a huge chain of people. But again, you also need a lot of money for that to happen. $100 is not going to make a huge difference for them. It will make a big difference for the people on the ground, who go out every day and look for wildlife and do surveys and things like that. And then, beyond direct support with money, I also like to train people to do sound recording. I've done this three or four occasions already, and people seem to learn eventually, and they get there, and they use these skills in very, very productive ways. because I can only be in a certain place for a couple of weeks at a time, and then I have to come back here, or maybe, you know, I have other things to do. But someone who lives in the Carpathian Mountains in the north of Romania, they're always there. They can always do sound recording, and they can keep an eye on the environment much better than I could ever hope for.
And you told me before that a way that you found to directly help these people that you do is that you donate boots and cameras and sound equipment and so much. Can you also talk about that?
Yep, anything. Cameras, sound recorders, microphones, binoculars, boots, whatever you can spare. You know, in my experience, in places like Romania or, you know, countries in Africa or South America, it's not like in the UK. In the UK, if you look at the National Trust or some of these big NGOs, they have a lot of funding. They can buy, they can afford to buy vehicles and kit and everything. But some of these very small organizations, they can use whatever you can spare. So even an old phone, for example, you know, they can use it to keep in touch or to, you know, you reuse the camera on it or something like that. So yeah, anything will make a difference. You just need to make sure you're donating to people who are doing work and not just people who are just who are saying, yeah, we're doing that, but not never actually.
How would you like to see the future of nature field recording developing?
I don't think about that very often. So for the future, something I work towards, I want sound recorders to be compensated properly. Because at the moment, when you think about it, you have to make it happen. If you go out and record and pitch a project or something, a trip or an expedition, it is almost impossible to get any support. You have to have worked on big projects like I have, or you know, maybe a handful of people have done that. Not everyone can afford to do that. But we need to start somewhere. There's people who would love to do this, and they're very skilled people, maybe more skilled than someone who already does some of this work, but they would never get the chance to start. So I think field recording needs to become like photography, you know, something that everyone is aware of. Maybe not many people are interested in, but it has to be an established art form and discipline. We need more courses and more people who are teaching it. We need more companies to understand the value of good sound recordings and good sound in general. And I think if we listen more, we are also better at field recording, of course. But it's the other way around. You know, if we teach people about field recording, they will learn to listen as well. And maybe we're not going to be just scrolling mindlessly through social media. Maybe we're going to spend more time investigating and listening and paying attention, you know, all that kind of good stuff.
I know you study, you read and research a lot, and I have a feeling that you are one of these people that works many hours daily. I'm not sure. But within all the work that you do, how do you incorporate all of that into your study and your life?
I find it difficult to not read. I've been reading all my life. You know, even when I was a kid, I used to read novels and, you know, big books. But I read for about an hour before I go to bed. I find that I fall asleep much more easily that way. I used to look at my screens until I went to bed and I had, you know, horrible sleep. I'd be more exhausted in the morning. Turning off all my screens around 8 p.m., you know, 9 p.m., I go to bed, read for an hour or even longer, and then could drift into sleep. That tends to work for me. So I'm off to Papua New Guinea in a couple of months. So I've read probably my sixth or seventh book about Papua New Guinea recently. Because it's a bit of research. It's also pretty exciting, and I love this stuff. I wouldn't be doing it if I wouldn't love it. Of course. So even if I work, I don't work 100 hours a week as I used to. I find that's damaging. But even if I work quite a lot, I always find the time to do a bit of reading. And we have reading hour as well. Me and my wife, sometimes we just turn off all the screens, all the phones and everything. We just sit and read. And Myrtle, the cat, loves it because she can have us to her attention without having competing screens or other exciting stuff.
About books, what are you reading at the moment? And also, what sort of books and reading materials would you recommend to a beginner field recordist?
Right. I'm reading a book about Papua New Guinea. It's basically about the story of Bruce Beeler. He's a researcher and ornithologist who moved to Papua New Guinea in 1975 for a year to work with the Smithsonian Institute in the US. And he discovered some unknown species of bird of paradise. And he did a lot of good research, and he kept going back for, you know, like decades. He wrote a few other books, very nice books, you know, with pictures of the birds of paradise. And I just like to read about his day-to-day work in the forest, how he got adjusted to the huge cultural differences between the Western world and Papua New Guinea. I have probably like 5 or 6 different books I cycle through, but that one's keeping all my attention at the moment. For field recordists, I know there's a focus on reading books about field recording and on field recording, which, you know, you can do that. You can exhaust, like, there's probably 10 books or 15 or 20 books maybe. But then you want more, and there's nothing else written about field recording. It's a good niche to get into probably this time. But there's all these adjacent skills that make my work easier and better in field recording. For example, I used to read about driving off-road, 4x4 driving. There's stories you can read about people getting into trouble and then taking themselves out of trouble, learning how to drive off-road, getting stuck. That inevitably, you know, if you go into an African country, you are going to run out of road at some point. So you have to be flexible. This is a good skill to have. Climbing trees. As a kid, I used to climb trees to eat pears and cherries and things. But those skills have transferred to field recording very easily. And I often climb trees to set up microphone rigs. Photography, you know, I've heard this from sound recordists. They say, since we are such a visual culture, we should focus away from visuals and just focus on the sound. But I think that's ignoring half of the story, probably, you know, being blind to it, if I may say so. Yeah, photography has helped my sound recording practice, you know, spending time in the field listening, but also trying to find a good frame and like a shot, you know, composing the frame. And then when you think about that, you also think, well, how am I composing the sound recording frame? How does that work? Does it include? What is likely to change over time? Because obviously sound takes more time than a picture to take, or it's more akin to video in that regard. Any kind of creative arts, you know, creative arts in general, there's good material out there about presenting your work. How do you present your work? There's a lot of people who find out about sound recording and they go out and they just flood the SoundCloud with their sound recordings, whether those sound recordings are worth sharing or not. This is a part of creative art practice. You can make art, but is all art worthy of sharing and showing to other people? Mm-hmm. Even if you're really excited, maybe if you have 20 recordings of the same thing, is the 21st still worth it? Or maybe you should do something else? Or are you getting any better? You know, how do you measure all this stuff? There's a lot of things like that. I like to read books by camera operators. And since I go out in nature and I work with wildlife so much, I like to read the stories of people who have gone to places that I want to go to, because that helps me understand those places even before I get there. And it's part of my research. Yeah, there's loads of stuff. I feel like you have to be too focused on sound recording to ignore other things. There's people who are like that. Maybe that works for them. But for me, I have to have an open mind to a lot of different disciplines.
You made a very interesting observation, I think. And I want to ask you regarding that. What do you think is a recording that is worth sharing?
You have to think about the story you're telling. What is the story? If you go out to record at 4 a.m. and you record distant traffic and a few geese or something on a lake, is there a story there? Or are you just posting it for your own excitement? Or I don't know. For me, everything that I do has to have a bit of a meaning and a story. Even if it's a bad recording, there has to be something behind it that makes it worthy of sharing. And if I'm learning and if I'm doing the same thing over and over to get better at it, I want to notice some progression as well. I want to notice that I am getting better. Otherwise, you know, the 100th recording that is the same thing over and over without any clear progress doesn't really make much sense to me. Mm-hmm. And then since my work also requires a lot of funding, I want to think about it in terms of building a portfolio. Mm-hmm. I've seen people who are looking for that one hero shot or hero sound recording that they're going to share and it's going to change their lives and everyone is going to come to them and pay them to do crazy things. I don't think it works like that. That might work for photographers. You know, if you get that one in a million shot of a whale eating a scuba diver or something, that might be something that's going to go viral. But with sound recordings, there's very few chances of that happening. You have to build a very consistent, very thorough, and very, very good quality portfolio. And then when people are going to Google your name, for example, when you're applying for a project, if they can find various things, you know, that sound good, that have a story behind them, that they enjoy listening to, they're much more likely to support your project. When you compare that with someone who's shared the same thing over and over and no clear progress and no clear story, and it's just flooding the websites and the internet with mediocre material, I think they're going to think twice before deciding to support you. It is a bit reductive. You know, art shouldn't have a reason, but unfortunately, that's how it works. You know, a lot of the trips that I've been on wouldn't have happened if I hadn't asked Rycote or Sennheiser or other companies and brands to support me. And then I built on that slowly, and then I ended up working with, you know, Hollywood studios and game studios and big tech and whatever.
So how do you juggle working these big contracts without losing your independent creative vibe?
In that case, I like to push my requirements. So even when I was working on Dune, I wanted to explain to Dave and to Richard over in LA what my aims were and what I wanted to do. Because maybe they gave me a list of things that I needed, you know, like a deliverable list. But I got a lot more than that, and I shared it with them, and they were extremely happy at the end, because they said whenever there was a bit of something that didn't fit quite well, they would just look through my folder and they find something that fit well. They put it in there and it was brilliant. So you have to deliver exactly what you're hired for. And then on top of that, you have to over-deliver. I know this can be a slippery slope. And, you know, if you overwork regularly, people might tend to give you more work than that. I think that's valid for a workplace where you go to, you know, in the morning and come back in the evening. But when you have projects like that, that are very creative and very high stakes, I think it makes sense to over-deliver and to give your best, you know, bring your best game. It's not about experimenting. When you're working on something like Dune or The Lion King, you have to just do the best you can. And that has to be top. There's no excuse. But then it also relies on your experience and how much you've done it before. If you've done it a lot, you know what to expect. You know what the most efficient way of doing things is. And then you have spare time where you can try new things and maybe add something that was not requested, but that would benefit the project. I don't know. Talking to people helps here, because it's inevitable. You're never going to understand the projects fully. You know, the vision of a director or of a creative director is huge. You know, it's complex. It's not something that you can explain in a few words. Yeah, you can summarize it, but if you go into detail, you're going to have to explore and experiment and have some experience there and have some previous cases in your portfolio that you can draw from.
Okay, so you work in these huge projects in that sense, and I guess you can still bring your own creativity to it all the time. But I guess what you're saying is that you are very resolute about being very objective and delivering the best that you can. Is that it?
Yes, maybe I was a bit too verbose. So I would deliver everything that was requested of me and try to get that done, and then try to leave some flexibility, some extra time for being creative. So once I'm, you know, 90% sure that I have everything that was required, I'm going to get a bit more of that and then try some new things, try some things that I want to do, I want to bring to that project. On Dune, I think I got everything they wanted. There was a few things that were not possible to get. And on top of that, I got, you know, hundreds of gigabytes of material that was just variations of certain things, or in between things that they required, or things that I thought would be good in the film based on, you know, having watched the first one and then read whatever materials I had and all the information. It's just allowing yourself enough time to get everything done, plus a bit of extra, a bit of flexibility. You know, initially, when you work with someone the first time, they're not going to encourage you to be very creative. But then once you build this relationship, they are going to ask for your opinion, and they're going to say, okay, if you think that's best, just go for it. And I think that's just about building a relationship. The director's vision is the one that leads. You know, you as a sound recordist or sound designer or composer or other professional on the team, your job is not to go crazy and put your own vision in there. Your job is to just tell the story however the director wants you to tell it. And sometimes there might be conflict. That's when, as someone who works for the director, you have to listen to them. I don't think there's any other way.
Right. So outside all of that, outside your work, what are things in your daily life that you enjoy doing?
I like to make jams. I love fruit and fruit jams. And my wife shares this passion of mine. So this house in Romania that we have a... So there was a big garden there, which used to grow vegetables, and we're not there all through the year, so we can't grow vegetables anymore. We planted a whole bunch of trees, pear trees, apple trees, cherries, a lot of berries, and we plan to go back there and make a lot of jams this year. Because my aunt used to do that, but she's getting a bit old, doesn't have much time, and she doesn't want to go to that effort anymore. what else? As I said, I like to read not just about field recording, but novels and sci-fi and fiction. Mm. I like to cycle, although I haven't been doing it regularly in the last year or so. My life does revolve around sound, so I find a way to bring anything into sound eventually. Yeah. I read about ecosystems and wildlife and things, and then it's a bit relevant to my work. I like exploring places. Even if I go somewhere, to not necessarily to record sound, I like to explore. I grew up reading Jules Verne, and you know his books were fascinating for me. I was always so excited about someone discovering a new world or something like that. So for me, going somewhere new where I've not experienced the dawn chorus yet or the sounds of wind, it's just very exciting on its own. And then, of course, it ties into my field recording practice as well. I like playing video games because I also work in video games. I don't have enough time to do that these days. And if I find something that's really exciting, I tend to forget about everything else for a couple of weeks or so, which is not good for my productivity.
And you like to spend time with your cat, that I know.
My cat is amazing. He's the best cat ever. And yeah, she knows it. She uses that for her advantage.
She's a cat.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think your brand name plays an important role in landing contracts and gigs? Based on your experience, what advice could you share with emerging field recordists? What would you say about that from a marketing point of view? And by the way, did you also learn marketing?
Yeah, that's a bit difficult to quantify. When you think about it, I think my biggest asset is my name, which is George Blood. I think Mindful Audio came up a bit later in my career. I have landed some gigs just because that was the name of my business. But most of the time, I could have done it with just using my name, I think. I think it's important to have a brand name, to think about one of them, either your name or a company name. If you don't do that, you're not going to come across as serious. People are going to think, oh, this guy's just an amateur. He's not very well established. Yeah, marketing is a huge thing for creative people. I used to dread the thought of putting myself out there and talking and asking for money, from clients and things like that. So I would always just get underpaid and people wouldn't know about me. But very slowly, I started to work on that, and I realized it was coming from imposter syndrome and a whole bunch of things that I had to address. And one thing that helped was getting good photographs in the field. I've learned photography, 10 years ago, and I don't regret it. I spent a few months studying photography properly, did a few online courses and watched a lot of videos and talked to people. And that has elevated my marketing game. I've put photos up that have attracted clients, and people have come back to me and said, oh, I saw that photo of you on a sand dune. Can you do this sound recording for me? And then, got a whole project from that. Because you like it or not, nowadays people first look at things and then tend to listen if they ever get to that. So you have to grab some of their attention. It's not very nice. In an ideal world, we just have sound recordings and they would speak for themselves and people would listen. But yeah, we have to adapt. And I don't mind it. I like photography, as I said. I like to get a good image. I like to document the places I'm going to. And that's part of it. Yeah. So I read Seth Godin's books, some of his books. He wrote a whole lot of things. A few of his books are very good. So one of the things that stuck to my mind is marketing is not like a PR agency or putting an ad on TV. Marketing is telling a story. And as humans, we always tell stories. We evolved over hundreds of thousands of years around campfires, talking about things, passing this knowledge through generations without being able to write it down. So telling a story was what we could do. People are excited to listen if you prime them. So if you tell somebody, I'm going to tell you a story, they're going to open their ears and they're going to listen for the story. If you just start telling the story, a lot of people might ignore you or not care about the stuff you're saying. It's a complex thing as well. And I don't, marketers exist for a reason. That's why they train and they do their work and they have experience. I don't claim to be any, professional marketer, but keeping on people's minds, keeping myself on people's minds is a good idea, because it's very easy to get disengaged and disconnected from social media because it's so toxic in some situations. Nowadays, it's used for a whole set of very shady reasons. As a tool, I think it's our responsibility to use it for the right reasons. You can do shady stuff with it, or you can just post things out and keep on people's minds and try to stay away from all that that toxic stuff.
How can people that appreciate your work can best support? What are your main channels for that?
I'm on YouTube. I think that's where I post the most things the most consistently these days. Instagram as well. I'm off Twitter. I don't care about that thing anymore. It's just a cesspool. LinkedIn as well. I think LinkedIn has been good for me over the years. I found a lot of potential clients and good connections on there. Yeah, if people want to support me, I want people to listen to my work. I don't care. You know, direct support is fine. You can buy me a coffee or I'm on Patreon as well. If people want to engage with me and talk to me, it's very difficult for me to reply on social media because I get bombarded with questions. But Patreon is a good way to engage with me. So, or email on my website. You can email me directly. Please don't email me about problems with your recorder. That's what the manufacturer is going to solve for you. I know it's very easy and I've had a lot of these questions, but more often than not, I'm not qualified to help you with that. But again, going back to what I was saying earlier, if people want to engage with me or support me, just listen to my recordings. I think that's the best thing, best outcome that I can hope for.
Finally, is there any more advice that you want to share or some tips or just say some words for the listeners?
Go out and record. I think we don't listen and record enough. We need more recordings. But, you know, if we go back to what we talked about curating your recordings, not everything you record is worth putting out there. Some will be, but if they're drowned in a sea of mediocre recordings, not many people are going to pay attention. So go get really good sound recordings and put them out there and share them with people. I think that's what we need to do as a society.